shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What do Walmart and prisons have in common? Both are becoming ubiquitous in rural New York State, and both employ slave labor. Walmart would no doubt take exception to that comment, but after you hear tonight's presentation by Charles Kernighan on the working conditions of the people who make their products, as well as those of Nike, Disney, and a host of other corporations, you decide. And in a documentary by Bruderhof Radio, we'll hear how depressed rural communities are heeding the siren's call of the prison industrial complex, which promises economic benefits that don't materialize. In 1981, Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger said, "What I propose is that as we embark on this massive prison construction program, we try a new approach. Convert our warehouses into factories with fences around them. To do that, we must change our thinking and change the reactionary statutes that stand in the way. I believe the American people are ready to do that." End quote. Welcome to slavery, New World Order style. Charlie Kernighan is the director of the National Labor Committee, an organization that monitors working conditions in the overseas factories that produce goods for American corporations. The following presentation was given in Seattle, Washington last fall prior to the WTO ministerial. We encourage you to tape this program and distribute this information to people who may not be able to hear these broadcasts.
Last week I spent the week with two women from El Salvador who worked in a maquila company, and they had been fired because they tried to meet to learn their rights. They worked in a place called Caribbean Apparel. This was Blanca Palacios and Lorena Carmen. They worked in Caribbean Apparel in El Salvador, where they sewed clothing for Kathy Lee Gifford's Walmart label and also for Kmart and Leslie Fay. Like I said, they were fired because they dared to meet to learn their rights and to defend themselves and end the maltreatments in the factory. I also was with a young man about 25 years old who was a union organizer, Giovanni Fuentes. And because he worked with the women in this factory, because he advised them on their legal rights, he received two death threats. He was called in by the company attorney and he was told, Giovanni, you and your friends should leave the work if you want to live. We suggest you leave the work. Giovanni, you understand that when you're dealing with the maquila in El Salvador, you're dealing with the mafia. And Giovanni, you have to understand that in El Salvador, you can have someone killed for 100 colones. That's about $12.50. That's why we took these workers immediately to the United States, to throw some protection over them, some public visibility. And it worked. And one of the reasons it worked was because of the students. We did a couple of press conferences. I was told there were 550 press hits, or radio stations, newspapers, or TV, enough to cover them, enough to protect them, to help protect them and defend their rights. They went back to El Salvador on Tuesday of last week, and we're monitoring the situation as closely as we can. Caribbean Apparel is typical of sweatshops throughout Latin America or Asia. It's located in a place called the American Free Trade Zone in Santa Ana. It's about an hour and a half from San Salvador. It's surrounded by the cinder block walls, by the barbed wire, by the locked metal gates, by the armed guards. Inside the factory, young women are locked for 12 hours a day, essentially 11-hour shifts, 6 days a week, from 6:50 in the morning till about 6:10 at night, or 6:40, and sometimes they work until 9:40. Of course, all the overtime work is forced. If they don't stay for the overtime, they're fired. The factory is about 100 degrees. There's no proper ventilation. It's a true sweatshop in that sense. The women are paid 60 cents an hour, which meets one-third of the cost of living. It's not even close to a subsistence wage. They made these Kathy Lee pants, and for every $16.96 pair of pants they made, they got paid 15 cents. These pants here. Supervisors went up and down the aisles. It's all done by piecework. They're all in the production lines. And they would smash the tables at a sewing machine and tell them to go faster. You know, stop your mind from wandering. Get down to work. You're not here for a vacation. They're not allowed to talk to each other. Typical in the factories, they could use the bathroom twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoon, and they need permission in order to use the bathroom. This place, like the other factories, they wouldn't give the workers clean water to drink. They drink filthy tap water. Women refer to it as urine. It's warm, it's yellow, it makes them sick to their stomach. In order to get a job, you had to take pregnancy tests. And if you tested positive, you were fired, you had to pay for those pregnancy tests. But the big issue was just fear. I mean, there was sexual harassment. If the supervisor liked one of the younger women and you didn't express interest in him, you'd be fired. They would scream at the workers. If they thought a worker was getting a little too uppity, they'd lock the young woman in a room in isolation for several hours. There were even incidences where the supervisors would jab the women with the scissors that, you know, they were cutting the threads off the clothing with. You know, just teach them a lesson. And there were even accounts of women being hit in the factory. But the biggest issue underlying the factory for the workers was the fear. The constant reminder that you'll be fired if you try to meet to learn your rights. That you'll be fired if you even carry around the country's labor code. Because if you have the labor laws of the country, you're a troublemaker. And you better get rid of that troublemaker before the disease spreads. You'll be fired if they even see you meeting and grouping together. Even if they don't know what you're meeting about, you'll fire three or four people just to send a message. You better not be meeting about something serious. You better not be meeting about your rights. And of course, if you try to organize, you won't be fired. You'll be blacklisted immediately. And those are the conditions at Caribbean Apparel. I'm going to come back to it, but of course, Kathy Lee got upset again and went on her television program and went on the attack. And we had a little run-in with her husband, Frank Gifford. And at the end of it, they were saying that Kathy Lee was the Joan of Arc of sweatshops. And the Washington Post commented, well, she must be hearing some very strange voices. And so we'll come back to it. I think they made a lot of mistakes, but they tried to crash our press conferences, and I think it blew up in their face. Well, I'm going to stick with El Salvador for a second. We were meeting with women at a factory called Dual, which in El Salvador, it's another one of the maquilas, which produces garments for export to the United States. And the women have told us over the years that they're forced to work, same thing, 6:45 in the morning until 7 o'clock at night, a 12-hour shift. However, three or four nights a week, they work until 10:30. So they're working a 15-and-a-half-hour shift. And right now, during the busy season, they work on Saturday until 6, and on Sunday they work until 5 o'clock. So they're working 7 days a week. And it's the same process. To get a job in these factories, you have to undergo these pregnancy tests. And if you test positive, you're fired. You come into the factory, and it's that same pressure to produce, 115 to 150 pieces an hour. The same screaming, the locked bathrooms, the no water. They tell us the factory is like vapor. It's like steam. Women are actually fainting during the workday. And the same fear that every time the workers try to meet to assert their rights, they're fired. This factory, this Dual factory, makes these Liz Claiborne garments. So, for example, at the Dual factory, they made this $198 Liz Claiborne jacket. The women were paid 74 cents to make it. So the wages that the women were paid come to only 0.4% of the retail price of the garment. We sent students down from Columbia University, graduate students, to meet with the women that worked in this Dual factory to do a living wage study. Well, the wage is adequate to survive on. Of course, they found out that the wages came to only about 1/3 of the real cost of living at a subsistence level. These are truly starvation wages, arbitrarily set, and we're going to release this report in about 2 weeks. But just because women from the Dual factory met with the students from Columbia University, they were fired. I think that's one of the reports we left outside. They were called in one by one, five women, and they said, the management said to them, you're fired for crying to the gringos, and we don't want a union here, just for meeting with U.S. students. And, of course, they've tried to organize a union at this particular factory five times, and each time it's been crushed with illegal firings and blacklistings. Not far from that factory, there was a place called Formosa Textiles, and we found out about this factory because a woman who had been working there had been beaten and fired. And she went into a human rights office, Codafarm in El Salvador, and she wanted to file a complaint. She wanted help. And she explained that she had been attacked at work, and they asked her what her crime was, what she did. She said, well, I took a day off from work because I'm a single mother, and I had a three-year-old daughter, and she was sick, and I had no money to put her to daycare. It cost about $1.63 a day for daycare. I didn't have a single cent, and I had to stay with her. When she went to work the next day, she was attacked by her supervisor, who was a man much larger than her, and she described that he grabbed her by the shoulders, and he took his knee, and he kneed her in the thigh very hard so that her whole thigh was black and blue. He tried to slap her a few times. As she ran away to escape, he tried to lunge out and kick her and knock her over. She ran away crying, and they fired her. And they said to her, well, what label do you make? And she made Nike shirts in El Salvador, so we can talk about Nike justice. By the way, the women were paid 20 cents to make this $75 Nike shirt. So this reaches almost new levels of exploitation. Maybe Disney's the only other company that comes close, because now the wages are down to 0.3% of the retail price of the garment. And the women walked us through their day. Exact same. I mean, I'm repeating myself. But to get a job in the factory, mandatory pregnancy test. They charge the workers 90 colones. That's 2 days' pay to take the test, and if they test positive, they're fired. The same forced overtime, 12-hour shift. And they help the workers stay. The Nike contractor helps the workers because at the end of the 8-hour shift, when you would be going home, say at 5:40, they keep them until 7 or later. They take the time cards away from them so that if they were to leave without staying for the overtime, they wouldn't be paid for the entire day. They'd lose the whole day's wages. Besides, if they didn't stay for the overtime, they'd be suspended without pay and then eventually fired. So you got the same forced overtime, the same pregnancy test, the same heat, lack of ventilation. And the women told us that they were searched on the way into the factory to take candy away from them. This is also typical. But Nike, you see, doesn't want the workers bringing in Tootsie Rolls. God forbid they should get a little chocolate stain on their garment. So on the Nike justice, you're searched. They take candy and water away from you. The women are not allowed to talk to each other because they need to keep the production going. In this particular factory, called Formosa Textiles, they brought in the supervisors. It's a Korean-owned factory in El Salvador. They brought the supervisors from Bangladesh because they figured the men would be a lot tougher on the women. And indeed, they were. And they would be yelling at them to go faster. For that reason, they were not allowed to use the bathroom. The same system. You raise your hand, you get a ticket, you present it to the guard at the toilet. You can use the bathroom once in the morning and once in the afternoon. You could drink water once in this factory. Same thing. Get the ticket, give it to the guard at the sink, and you could drink the filthy tap water. That makes the woman sick. In this factory, you couldn't wear any makeup, which struck us, you know, we hadn't heard that one before. Like, why can't you wear makeup? And, of course, it was because the factory was 100 degrees, and Nike was afraid that the women would sweat and wipe the perspiration from their faces with the Nike garment, and if they were wearing lipstick or other makeup, it would, again, soil the garment. Nike would lose a few pennies. So that's a serious offense. They patrol the aisles looking for lipstick. And if you got it, you're out of there, and you're fined, and you lose the day's pay. The same firings, the same fear. Anyone who stood up to defend their rights or even question their rights was fired. And I said to the women in the factory, like, what about the Nike code of conduct? You know, they say they got this code of conduct that defends the rights of workers everywhere in the world. And the workers said, sure, they have a code of conduct. They make us wash our hands in the morning. That's the part of it they impose because they don't want us getting the garments dirty. And when we do white Nike garments, they give us plastic gloves to wear. So that was their code of conduct. That was the Nike code of conduct and Nike justice. Now, I don't know if you can see these, but this is the factory that made the Liz Claiborne garments. It's exactly like the factory that made the Nike garments. It could be, it's in El Salvador, but it could be anywhere in Central America or anywhere in Asia. It's always the same. The cinder block wall or a concrete wall 15 foot high, topped with the razor wire, the locked metal gate, and the young women lining up to go into work. If any students here, if you came up afterwards and looked at this, these people are younger than you are. But they're not in a great university. They're not getting an education. They're going into factories where they're locked for 12 hours a day. You can see, they're very young. And on the ground, there's pieces of plastic because there's no place for them to eat. So when they come out during lunch hour, they either sit in the mud or the dirt. And to protect themselves, they bring a piece of plastic, which is why the plastic's laying around. When the door opens, the young women go through. And behind the door, there's always an armed thug. He jumped out of the way when he saw my camera. And, you know, it's not like they carry little sticks or batons. They carry sawed-off shotguns and big rifles. All of these factories are in exactly the same position. In El Salvador, 80% of the workers, at least, are women. 50% of them are single mothers, young women. They go into these factories where they're locked behind the metal gates, the thugs, the barbed wire. I'm going to tell you a short story about trying to research these places and what it's like for the women. We were out in front of this Dual factory, and we always try new techniques, because everything you do has to be done in a clandestine manner. You could never walk up in front of these factories to do interviews. I've been in front of these factories when the armed thugs have kept out members of the labor ministry. And they just laugh at the people from the government. They say, oh, the boss isn't here you want to see. Come back tomorrow. And, of course, if you went back tomorrow, the boss isn't there either. No one goes in and out of these factories that the thugs don't want to go in there. If any of the students here worked in a factory there and their parents wanted to get them a message or there was an emergency or medicine or some message, they'd be shot before they could get into these factories. Well, we were using a van with polarized windows. We figured we could do some of our interviews like that. We'd take the van, we'd park it about maybe 100 yards away from the factory, and we'd have fired workers who we were working with would go out of the van back to the workers during lunchtime, and she'd say, there's some labor rights people from the United States. They're interested in your case. Perhaps they can help. And the women would come around to the van. We'd throw open the door. They'd jump in the van. We'd smash the door, close it shut, and no one could see us. You couldn't see into this van. And we did a lot of interviews like that. Someone saw us from the factory. And we're sitting in the van doing an interview, and all of a sudden a pickup truck comes up behind us, and the doors open on both sides, and two guys get out with shotguns, and they make a big sweep coming towards our van like that. And we decided, on a spur of the moment, just pull out as fast as we could possibly go. And obviously we did. And we left. As we made the turn, there was a bus stop, and we left the women off at the bus stop so that they could innocently pretend they were waiting for a bus. We kept going. This truck followed us for about 15 minutes, it felt like that. It felt endless. So it's not possible to just waltz up to these places and research. A little while ago, I'm losing track of time, but it was this summer, we were in El Salvador with students from five different universities on a delegation. We're making a video about the student movement. And we wanted to make a video through the students' eyes, what it was like when they met with workers their own ages. What was like when they saw the factories? What was it like when we went into the neighborhoods and saw how people live? What was it like to talk to people who had been beaten up by their managers and fired? Well, we went to a Nike factory, the factory that makes this, Formosa Textiles and Evergreen. And, of course, we were turned away by the armed guards. We were not allowed entry, even though we told a few white lies. The students said that they were interns, student interns with Nike, but they didn't fall for it. And the manager came out and said, Nike determines who comes in and out of this factory, period. And they didn't alert us to your visit, so you're not coming in. But you could see the workers with little Nike vests on, little swishes, with the armed guards, and they were working behind the fence. We left there. We went to a place called Santa Ana, where the Caribbean Apparel factory was also located. And through the research, we knew there was a factory called Exmotica, which also made Nike's clothing, but children's clothing. We went to the factory, we got there just at lunchtime, and the gate was open because the workers were coming in and out for lunch. There was an armed guard right next to the door. I had some Nike clothing I'd purchased in New York because we're doing research on the pricing of the garments. So I said to the students, let's go. The door's open. We walked right up. The armed guard figured we must be North American buyers or whatever. We said good afternoon to him, and we walked right past the guy with the gun, and we went into the factory. And we're walking around the factory, and yes, it was confirmed. They were making Nike's children's clothing. They were doing Adidas. They were doing Lee. And You know, I get nervous when I do this. We're in the factory. I knew we were going to get, you know, captured eventually. And we're taking pictures and we're doing a videotape and I'm doing an interview standing up inside the factory. And I found labels that said made in the USA. Now, either they were doing transshipments, illegal transshipments, or maybe they were samples. But anyway, we're eventually surrounded, you know, maybe it took about 5 minutes. We're eventually surrounded by the management. And I expected them to say, you know, throw us out and yell and scream a little bit. And they're asking me, what are you doing in here? And I said the door was open, which it was, and we're in here and they're screaming. But then they turned very violent and they attacked the students, especially the women. And they saw the cameras and they went ballistic. And so they're grabbing the students and they're trying to pull them down. At the same time, they're trying to drag the cameras off their necks. And at first, the students were resisting. And, you know, eventually I was watching this thing and it was getting kind of rough and almost out of control. So I said to everybody, give up the film. They broke one of the cameras. They took the film. And I see the manager and he's standing there and he's going like this. He's screaming at the top of his lungs. He's going like this. Of course, he's calling over the shotguns, which they did come. Then we were surrounded by the people with the shotguns. So this is North American students in a factory, and we're being attacked, and we're surrounded by these thugs and these goons. Well, they did take the camera, but I was hooked up with a microphone, so which they didn't discover. So at least we got out with the sounds of these people screaming at us, yelling and telling us in El Salvador we'd do anything we damn well please. And in fact, the factory Ex Modica is owned by the sister of the former president of El Salvador, Calderon Sol, who's really the power behind the recently elected President Flores. And when we came out of the factory, we knew we only had a little bit of time to get away from there because they would call the police. So we left there and we went to a square in Santa Ana and we interviewed the students immediately, right after this incident in the factory. And it turned out to be really very moving because the students had tasted a tiny bit of the repression that these workers face every single day. If they're doing that to students from Yale and from University of Kentucky and Middlebury and Vermont, if they're doing this to the students, the message came through loud and clear. The women in that factory have no rights. If they ever stood up for higher wages or more respect or dignity, they would be handled very, very, very toughly. Salvadorans we were with told us, labor people, human rights people, that if they had gone into the factory with us, they'd probably be hanging up somewhere getting electric shock treatment, you know. We were laughing about it afterwards because we were so nervous. But those interviews are going into the tape we're doing now. Mikey's happy about it. The tape left that factory, the Nike factory. They stole a tape out of one of the video cameras and they sent it to a factory that produces for Walmart, which was why the death threats came about, because they saw our discussions on this tape, why that Giovanni was threatened with death. Well, you know, in El Salvador right now, there's 225 factories, used as an example, 225 maquila factories, 70,000 young women working in those factories. They produce 581 million garments a year for export to the United States. It's up now. It's 50 million garments a month. El Salvador, tiny El Salvador, is the seventh largest exporter of apparel to the United States worldwide. Imports of apparel have grown from 198 million in 1992 to 1.2 billion last year, a 600% increase. Everything's booming except worker rights. There's not one single union in any of the maquila in El Salvador because it's not allowed. Despite the pregnancy test, the starvation wages, the beatings, the humiliation, people being stripped of their rights, despite all of that, the heat, the lack of water, the locked bathrooms, there's not one single union because every time the workers try to defend themselves, they're fired and blacklisted. Not one. The maquila is booming. Now there's talk in El Salvador of lowering the wages from 60 cents an hour to 36 cents an hour. They say it's too high. The 60 cents. This is the World Trade Organization. They're saying it's too high. It's too high. We better lower it in the countryside to 36 cents an hour. Well, you know, if Nike had the chance to come in here, that would be nice if they did. If Nike came in here, they'd say to you, you're a decent people here. Sunday night, what are you doing here? You should be home watching television or something. But don't be naive. 60 cents is a good wage. You're not living in Seattle or New York City. You're in El Salvador, you can live on 60 cents. It's a good wage. These are good jobs. And when you ask the women about that, they look you right in the face and they say it's a lie because you cannot live on the 60 cent wages. And they run us through their day real quickly that just to get back and forth to work costs 68 cents. a tiny breakfast at the job, since they're getting up so early. You know, when you think of it, when they're working these 6:45 in the morning shifts, 6:45 until 7 o'clock at night or 10:30, workers are getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and getting home at 7:30 or 11:30 with no chance at all to spend with their children. I mean, it's completely, what strikes you is the exhaustion of the people, the bags under their eyes, the lack of sleep, the lack of any decent food, the constant pressure and screaming at the workers. Well, anyway, they spend 80 cents for a small breakfast, rice, beans, you know, maybe a little roll, a cup of coffee. For lunch, it cost them $1.49, the exact same thing. Rice, beans, maybe a scrap of chicken, tortilla, and a lemonade, fake lemonade they call it, because they can't afford soda, it's too expensive. Well, that's $2.97. The wages are 60 cents an hour, actually a little bit less. So the daily pay is 42 colones, which is $4.79. So your daily pay is $4.79, you take out $2.97, just for the round trip bus and for breakfast and lunch, and you're left with $1.82. Well, you have to live somewhere. So for a one-room hovel in El Salvador that a whole family will share, one room, without indoor plumbing, you use an outhouse, and there'll be one sink that several families will share, that's $31.40 a month. That's $1.03 a day. Well, you take the $1.03 from the $1.82 and you're left with 79 cents. But what do you do now? The cheapest supper you can have is about $1.14. For the exact same thing, a family of three, 38 cents apiece. Each person would be allotted 38 cents to each supper, rice, beans, maybe they'd split one plantain for a family of three, and coffee. Well, they can't even afford that because they're only left with 79 cents. Women in El Salvador are raising their children on coffee because they can't afford milk. Something is completely crazy and viciously wrong when women could be making $75 Nike shirts and yet they're raising their children on coffee. Or they're making the Liz Claiborne jackets, $198 jackets, and they're raising their children on coffee. They tell us maybe the two paydays, they're paid every 14, 15 days, maybe on those two paydays they buy a little bit of milk. But they can't afford any vitamins, or they can't afford any vegetables, or cereal, or juice for their kids. Nothing. And you ask them what they would do if they had a little bit better a wage. And they say they'd buy milk, school books, clothing for their kids to go to school. It costs $8 for new shoes to send your kid to school. Like I said before, about $1.63 a day for daycare. None of this can they afford. The Nike shirts, it's a special shirt. It says that it takes the sweat off your body and throws it into the air so you stay dry. And when we read this to the women, they all started laughing. They said, well, we need these things because it's 100 degrees in the factory. We ought to be wearing them. And, well, what would happen if Nike paid a subsistence wage to the workers? The workers have told us that if they could have their wages increased from 60 cents to about $1.18 an hour, they could climb out of misery and into poverty. Now, would the whole sky fall in on Nike if they paid a subsistence wage? If Nike paid them $1.18 an hour, there would be 39.5 cents of labor in the shirt, which is less than 0.5% of the retail price of the shirt. At 60 cents an hour, there's 20 cents of labor. At $1.18 an hour, there would be 39.5 cents. In other words, there's enormous greed driving this whole thing. Enormous greed. And the students should never pull back from the issue of a living wage. It's very possible. And if you keep going, you're going to win this thing. The Liz Claiborne jacket, 74 cents of labor in it. If Liz Claiborne paid the workers a sustainable wage, there'd be about $1.44 or $1.45 of labor in this jacket, less than 0.9% of the retail price of the garment. They could easily afford to do it. The other day, that's actually 2 months, Nike put out a press release. They're very sophisticated. They spend $650 million a year in advertising. They put out a press release and they said, we are raising the wages of our workers in Indonesia from 250,000 rupiah to 265,000 rupiah. And a 6% wage increase. And the media applauded and actually recognized the great social conscience of Nike. And I smelt a rat. I figured something's going on here. So I went and I looked up the value of the rupiah to the dollar. And of course, at that particular time, there were 10,080 rupiah to the dollar. So Nike gave a wage increase, all right, from 14 cents an hour to 15 cents an hour. They gave a 1 cent increase to their workers. Nike's got 70,000 workers in Indonesia. Nike makes 20 million pairs of sneakers a year in Vietnam, paying the workers 33 cents an hour. And in China, Nike uses one factory compound called Yuyan, where there are 50 to 60,000 workers in one factory complex. There are only 37,000 footwear workers left in the entire United States. There's more workers in one factory making sneakers for Nike in China than there is in the entire United States. I was in China this summer, and we went to in northern China to a city called Jiaozu, and there were 21,000 workers there making Nike sneakers. And Nike had swooshes on the factories, and it said, "Just do it," right behind the barbed wire and the locked metal gates and the thugs. They're very proud of it. The workers were paid 23 cents an hour, and they were working 12-hour shifts. Just do it. Nike's very proud of itself. We went into a factory in China that made kid sneakers. And the women in the factory, very young, we'll come back to this, but all of the workers in China are 17 to 25 years of age. At 25 years of age, you're fired because of the 16-hour shifts. You're all used up anyway, and you may get pregnant, and they're not going to pay maternity benefits, so you're gone at 25. Well, in this factory, the women look very young, 16 or even younger. And they were putting the glue on the kids with their bare hands. Toxic glue was right next to them. XXX strong, which they couldn't, of course, couldn't read. But when you went through the factory, your eyes were stinging you. And the implement they had given the workers was a toothbrush. So they had the toxic glues and they were putting it on with the toothbrush in their hands. And there was no respirators, no nothing, no gloves, zero. No proper ventilation. And at the end of the day, the workers had to leave the factory in single file as an imposition of discipline on these workers. If you were the head of a production line, you were like production line one. Well, you stood up with your sign one, and all of the workers at the end of the day had to gather together behind you in single file, and you left the factory. Whole lines of workers like that, just to let them know who the boss is, and that discipline will be maintained. And it wasn't just sneakers and garments, although there was a company called Deep E, which is a small progressive shoe company in Oregon. And they said they're a part of Corp America, and they said that we use hemp, natural hemp, but we make the shoes in China, and the workers get paid $3.15 an hour. This is what the boss said. Well, we found the factory. It took us a long time to find it. It's the middle of nowhere. But it was surrounded by four guard towers, like a prison camp. The workers were locked in. There were dormitories there. And in fact, they were paid 23 cents an hour. So they were off several thousand percent in their estimate of the wages. And a lot of that goes on because no one's watching. No one's looking. We went into a factory that made Alpine car stereos, the top of the line. I mean, if you check your car stereo, you'll see if it's an Alpine stereo, made in China. The women were forced to work 10 hours a day, and they sat at microscopes, and they did the soldering of the very fine pieces. And they'd be there. I don't know how they would be able to concentrate for 10 hours like that, looking through these microscopes. I mean, it must have been so exhausting. And above them was an electronic scoreboard informing them what their daily production quota was, how many stereos they should have produced, as opposed to how many stereos they did produce, and they were monitored like that every few minutes. They were paid 35 cents an hour. Top of the line technical job in China, 35 cents an hour. And we'll come back to this. Of course, no right to organize, no independent unions, no independent religious or human rights groups, no independent independent women's groups, zero. Well, talk about Phil Knight's greed a little bit. The guy is worth $5.8 billion, the Nike guy. $5.8 billion. And I sat down one Saturday and I wanted to figure out, what the hell do you do with $5.8 billion? What can you do with it? Well, how much money do these people need? So I called a travel agent and I said, I want to fly around the world first class. And they told me $10,282.50. Then I called the Waldorf Astoria in New York and I said, I want a room and I want three meals a day and don't give me no continental breakfast. I want the real thing. Three meals a day. I could get that for about $500. And then I called a car dealership and I wanted a brand new Lincoln Continental. And I was told I could get one for $36,000. Phil Knight could fly around the world first class every single day. He could stay at the Waldorf Astoria and have three meals every single day. He could buy a brand new Lincoln Continental every single week, and he could do it for the next 1,044 years. And yet they continued to suck the wealth off the backs of young women locked in factories around the world who were stripped of their rights. Same thing with Disney. You know, Disney produces the garments, some of its garments in Haiti. We have a nice little surprise for Disney with one of its sweatshops in Africa, but we'll leave that for later. But Disney makes these garments, made these garments, the 101 Dalmatian and the Pocahontas, made them in Haiti, and where the workers lived in utter misery. And we were asked by the workers to come to their homes. They said to us, we think it would really surprise you. And we said, of course we'll go. We'll do anything that you want us to, because we want to take your struggle back to the people of the United States. And we're in this little hut, and it's like maybe 10 by 12. And there's no windows. It's mud and stone walls with a corrugated roof, scrap metal, and one light bulb hanging down, one bare light bulb. And I'll never forget it. Like, we're crushed into the room, and there's nothing there. I'm standing in the room, and I'm looking around, and I realize there's no refrigerator, there's no fan, there's no toys, there's no clothing, there's no water, there's nothing. There was one kitchen table and two cots. And I said to the woman, well, where do you get your water? She worked for the Disney company making this clothing. She said, well, we have to buy it in buckets down the block, and we need 6 buckets a day at 8 cents a bucket. 48 cents a day. That was more than she came home with after making clothing for Walt Disney. She didn't even have enough money to buy water for her kids. I said, oh, where's the bathroom? She takes me outside, and it's a hole in the ground that the family share. Literally, just that, a hole in the ground. We go back inside, and her children were there, and they were laying on the cots, and they didn't look good. And I said to her, how are they? What are they doing home? And Haiti, of all countries, was forced by, you know, the IMF and that bunch to privatize its primary education. So they have to have money to go to school, and she didn't have money to have them go to school, so the kids are in school 2 weeks, they're out 2 weeks, they're in school a week. Whenever they can afford it, they go back to school. The children were sick. One had dysentery, the other malaria. She had no money for medicines. There was no food. I said to them, what are you going to eat tonight? And she says, nothing. We frequently go to bed hungry. Out of these discussions, the worker said to us, do you think that we could approach the Walt Disney Company for a 58 cent an hour wage? They're making 28 cents an hour. And we felt like saying to them, come on, this is the Disney Company. Don't ask 58 cents. Well, they were very modest, very realistic. They said, no, no, we're a very poor country. If we could get 58 cents an hour, we can put food on the table for our families 2 or 3 nights a week. For us, that would be an amazing step forward. May not be much to you, but for us, it would be a great deal. Well, when we approached the Disney Company with the workers' request, we were told to get lost, to go to hell, we must be out of our minds. The 28-cent wage is a good wage. In fact, the guy who actually was in charge of producing the clothing, a company called H.H. Cutler, he said, look, they're alive, aren't they? Must be a living wage. So this is the kind of mentality, this is what you're dealing with. So we went back to El Salvador, to Haiti, with the garment, and it was $19.99, 101 Dalmatian garment. We talked to the workers, and we found out what the piece rate was for every single operation. And I forget now. I think it was like 13 steps to assemble it. Went down like at 11 pieces. There were 13 steps to assemble it. The total wages in the Disney garment was 6 cents. Six cents of wages in a $19.99 garment. In other words, 0.3% of the retail price of the garment. If Disney doubled the wages, it would have no impact on the price of the garment whatsoever. Zero. It'd be 12 cents of wages in a $20 garment. Nothing. Well, that doesn't have much impact on Michael Eisner, who last year paid himself $177 million. Compensation and wages and all the rest. That's $3.4 million a week, $104,000 an hour. So Michael Eisner pays himself $104,000 an hour and pays the workers in Haiti 28 cents. It's slavery, just like was said earlier. And they tell us that the marketplace is the best allocator of resources. And how dare you talk about a living wage or subsistence wages? You know, when PVH, Phyllis Van Heusen, shut down the only unionized factory in all of Guatemala, which they did last Christmas, right before the Christmas holiday. Phyllis Van Heusen owned a factory in Guatemala. It was the only unionized factory, and it had to be destroyed because the workers were making $1.09 an hour. And they were afraid that would spread around Guatemala. So PVH, they're on the president's task force for human rights and worker rights. PVH shuts the factory down, throws the workers in the street, and then sources the work out to factories that are paying 36 cents to 50 cents an hour where there are miners working and where there's forced overtime. And they get a pat on the back from the White House for their human rights work. The minute that Klatsky was throwing the workers out, he's the CEO of PVH, he gave himself a $700,000 bonus. And I looked into his financial records. You know, these people don't even pay for their kids to go to school. He gets $71,000 a year grant from the company to send his little kiddies to college. He makes $2.6 million a year. You think he could afford it. And they don't even pay co-payments for health. It's unbelievable what these people do. He took another $30,000 or $40,000 in co-payments for his whole family for their health maintenance. And they throw these workers out because they were making $1.09 an hour. Well, I went into the Sports Authority not that long ago, and I bought this Yankee Blazer jersey in honor of them winning the World Series. And I look inside, and it says, Made in Burma. Now, you know better than I know this tremendous activism. People have done enormously fantastic work here, which is spread all across the country. But you know better than I do that the place is a concentration camp, that the military, you know, really solidified their power in 1988 when they gunned down thousands of people on the street who were marching for the right to vote and for democracy, students, union people. And now the country's run by a vicious military dictatorship that keeps the people in line through terror, rape, torture, ethnic cleansing, murder, you name it. In Burma, you go to prison for 20 years for criticizing the military dictators. You'll go to jail for 15 years for having a fax machine under the science law. And it is a concentration camp. President Clinton did one good thing. He said, let's stop all new U.S. investments in Burma until the military thugs are out. No new U.S. investments. That was May of 1997. Strange thing happened. The U.S. apparel companies in 1998 increased their imports from Burma by 44%. What sanctions? They laughed in his face, and they increased the imports by 44% to $110 million a year. Why were the U.S. companies in Burma? Well, they could pay 6 cents an hour, the lowest wages in the world. $8 a month for a 60-hour work week. And it even gets better, because the military is brought into the factories the first hint of any dissatisfaction on the part of the workers. And the workers know that they'll be taken off to prison and tortured. So you don't have a whole lot of dissent in the factories where the U.S. companies really feel at home there. But it gets worse, because the military is not stupid. So they don't allow wholly owned foreign subsidiaries. You have to be in a joint venture with guess who? The military or the drug lords. About 90% of the factories are joint ventures with the military dictators, 10% with the drug lords who run 65% of the heroin to the United States. So the U.S. companies are in bed with the military. The money the military makes off the apparel trade, they made $2 billion off of it since 1988. They go to China, purchase weapons, come back, and murder and torture their own people. And the U.S. companies say to us, you know, why are you always attacking us? Don't you see the good side, the softer side of Sears and the softer side of these companies? Well, I think I'm going to talk about Walmart briefly, because if we're looking at the global economy, the global sweatshop economy, Walmart's the place to begin. Walmart is the largest retailer in the world. It's the largest retailer in Canada, the largest retailer in the United States. They've entered Germany, they're entering the United Kingdom now. They're becoming the largest retailer in Mexico. Walmart is the largest private sector employer in the United States. Most people don't know about it. General Motors, of course, used to be the largest employer. At $46 an hour, $26 in wages, $20 in benefits, General Motors is no longer the largest employer in the United States, but it's the largest employer in Mexico, 50 to 65 cents an hour. And we've got now Walmart as the largest employer. Maybe, you know, about $6.10 an hour average wage. And they cap the work week, they attempt to cap the work week at 25 hours so they don't have to pay benefits. That leaves one half of Walmart's employees eligible for food stamps. So the largest employer in the United States on the verge of the millennium, one half of its employees qualify for food stamps. Besides destroying neighborhoods and all the rest and putting small businesses out and destroying downtown areas, Walmart's also the largest sweatshop abuser in the world. their annual sales, $137.6 billion. That makes Walmart larger than 155 countries in the world, and there are 192. Walmart's annual sales are larger than the gross domestic product, the entire economic output of 155 countries. What does Walmart do with that power? Well, this is Walmart and the World Trade Organization. Walmart uses that power to play these countries off against each other. You want Walmart work? You can have it, but I won't have any unions, and I won't have any regulations, and no occupational health and safety, and I won't have any red tape, and I won't have any environmental protections. You know that? I won't have anything. And I want low wages, starvation wages. And Walmart plays countries off against each other. Who's going to give them the best deal? They don't pay a single cent of taxes. For example, in the Kathy Lee label with Walmart, this clothing that was made in El Salvador, the entire government revenue in El Salvador is $1.8 billion. The government brings in $1.8 billion in revenues to provide basic needs to 6 million people, over 6 million people. Walmart's annual sales of $137.6 billion means Walmart's revenues are 76 times greater than the entire country of El Salvador, yet Walmart doesn't pay 1 cent of taxes in those free trade zones. Zero. And in El Salvador and these other countries, you don't even have to be in the free trade zones anymore. They've turned the entire countries into sweatshops. So you can set a factory up anywhere, and you don't pay taxes. If you're a multinational, you're going to come in and gouge the low wages. You do it scot-free, no tariffs whatsoever. Walmart, we were going around, and we'd find things like this, these Kathy Lee blouses. And this is sort of epitomizes the race to the bottom. Kathy Lee and Walmart, we always notice a change when we go into the Walmarts. It's as if they chase collapsing currencies and misery. So when we were doing this research, the two big producers were Mexico and Indonesia, both places where the currencies, fell through the floor. Well, anyway, these shirts will hang right next to each other. They're exactly the same. Kathy Lee blouses, $16.96. Because there's one small difference. One was made in the United States, $8.42 an hour, $1.70 of labor in this blouse. This blouse was made in Mexico, 50 cents in an hour of wages, 17 cents of labor in the blouse. Yet they both cost the exact same thing. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that these jobs are going here very fast. You'd have to be an idiot to stay here and pay, so much more. And in fact, in the last year, in the United States, we've lost 475,000 manufacturing jobs. Well, what kind of a company is Walmart? People remember maybe back in 1992 when NBC, Dateline, went with a nun to Bangladesh, and the nun took them through the factory, and they had hidden cameras, and they found children 9 years old to 12 years old on 3 floors in the factory making clothing for Walmart, shirts. The kids were paid 5 to 8 cents an hour, and they worked until midnight, and if they made mistakes, the kids told the nun they hit us, and they punched us. They took the tapes back to David Glass, the CEO of Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas, and they showed him the tapes. And he looked at the tapes, and he said, "These images don't mean a thing to me. You and I define child labor differently." They took the tape back to Bangladesh, and they showed it to the factory owner, who had been working under contract with Walmart for over a year. He looks at the tape, and he looks up at them, and he says, no. He said, "You have it all wrong. You only think that those are children. They're really malnourished adults." So this is the moral fiber of the World Trade Organization and the corporations. You only think they're children, but it's different. They're really malnourished adults. We recently found Walmart in a factory called Beximco in Bangladesh, where they were paying the workers 20 cents an hour. They're supposed to earn 33 cents an hour. They were paying them 20 cents an hour. They were forcing them to work 7 days a week, from 7:30 in the morning until 8 o'clock at night. Overtime is supposed to be double time. So if it's 33 cents, they're supposed to be getting 66 cents an hour. Walmart paid 20 cents an hour and paid overtime and straight time, the same 20 cents. For an 80-hour work week, they pay the workers $16. They're supposed to earn $36. Walmart, the largest, most profitable retail in the world, is stealing $20 a week from some of the poorest people in the world. That's how they make their money. And yet Walmart's operating profit last year was $7.6 billion, and the Walton family is worth $67.5 billion. But they have to cheat the people in Bangladesh of a 33-cent wage or a 66-cent wage with overtime. Again, there's enormous greed through the system. About a month ago, a bunch of people were killed in another fire in Bangladesh because they're locked in the factories, there's metal grates on the windows, there's no fire escapes, no fire extinguishers, and the women bash through the grates. They're up on the third or fourth floor. They try to tie some of the clothing together and go out, and the rope collapsed. 5 were killed, and 50 were seriously injured, 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds, making clothing for the U.S. companies. Well, I think you know about Saipan. This is a beautiful scheme. This is really what the World Trade Organization would applaud, I think. In Saipan, the American companies figured out, well, look, at this place is U.S. territory. What good is it? Let's figure out what we can use it for. So U.S. territory, but it's not covered by immigration law. It's not covered by minimum wage law, but it's U.S. territory. So the U.S. companies figured out that they could take their partners from China, have them relocate their factories to Saipan, and they could put on the clothing made in the USA. Send it back to the United States, so you'd buy a piece of clothing that said made in the United States, but of course it was made in Saipan in the territory. It was made by workers paid $2.15 below the U.S. minimum wage. It was made by workers locked in factories 12 and 14 hours a day. And how the scheme worked, they sent recruiters to China, where they recruited 15,000 young women a year, bring them to Saipan. They were told they were coming to the United States, they'd get good jobs, high wages, good living conditions. They only had to pay $5,000 as a recruitment fee, which, of course, they couldn't pay. They'd have to work off. So the women came to Saipan. Little did they know, they're locked in factories and locked in dormitories. When they got there, they charged them $200 a month for room and board. So if you add it up, it's $5,000 recruitment fee, $2,400 a year for room and board. That's $7,400. Well, if the women were making $3 an hour, which they were, and if they're working 45-hour work week, they could not even pay their debt off if they worked every single day for the entire year. In other words, two things are obvious. They weren't working 45 hours a week. They were working 7 days a week, and they're working 12 to 14 hours a day, not 8 hours a day. The second thing that's obvious is that they were indentured servants because it took them the whole period to pay off their debt to the recruiters and to the companies. And it gets even worse in that the workers had to sign what they called a shadow contract. And if they became pregnant, they would be fired and deported. If they fell in love or got married or attempted to get married, they'd be fired and deported. If they wouldn't work the overtime, they'd be fired and deported. If they criticized working and living conditions, they'd be fired and deported. If they wouldn't lie to inspectors that came in to the factories or to the dorms, they would be fired and deported. It got so disgusting that if they became involved in religious activities, which would drain their energies from work, they would be fired and deported. And of course, they'd be sent back to China in enormous debt that they could never pay off. And of course, they would suffer any kind of retaliation that the recruiters wanted to bring against them because they were working hand in glove with the government. Walmart produces in Saipan in a factory called Mirage. They're in the same factory with the Gap and with J. Crew and the Limited. Well, I want to talk briefly about my friend Kathy Lee Gifford because I can't leave her out of this. That a few years ago when she was crying on television and threatening to sue me, if you remember, she was shedding these crocodile tears and she was waving a letter I had written to her. And she was saying, "Mister, sit by your telephone. You're going to get a call from my attorney. You can say I'm ugly. You can say I can't sing. You can say I can't act, all of it true. But don't dare say that I don't love little kitties. And Mister, sit by your telephone." So I can explain the background. We were in Honduras, and young women approached us, and they said, "Would you meet with us? We have a lot of problems at our factory." And we do the same thing like we always do. We meet in a clandestine place, a safe house. In this case, it was a food stand about 100 yards away from the factory. The owner is a supporter of human rights. He's always let us meet there. We're safe. So he said that to the woman. "Go on down to the food stand. There's a big fence. We'll meet behind the fence." The meeting's about to start during lunch break. Just as we're going to start the meeting, 3 young guys walk in. And the women point to the 3 guys and they say, "These guys are spies. And every single thing we say will go right back to the boss. We can't meet." And it was very tense confrontation with these guys. Well, what the women did, they started to file out and they started putting their hands underneath an old table I was standing next to. And I realized they're trying to give me something. So I put my hand under the table and sure enough, they were putting into my palm their pay stubs, so we would know how much they got paid, who they were, and the labels that they made in the factory. So we would know their names, the pay, the labels. And when they walked out, and I took my hand out from underneath, this was the label I had, Kathy Lee Gifford. These were the pants they made. They were paid 25 cents for every $19.96 pair of Kathy Lee pants they made for Walmart and for Kathy Lee. I just happened to have a blow-up of Kathy Lee Gifford. She doesn't appreciate this. I don't know why, but this has upset Frank, too. We'll come back to him. Well, she's happy, and she's got a lot of teeth. And the bottom of it says, a portion of the proceeds from the sale of this garment will be donated to various children's charities. It's very touching. Before anybody weeps, these are the workers. They leave out the tiny fact that it was children that were making the clothing. So Kathy Lee Gifford's pants was being made in Honduras by 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. And somehow they're telling us, if we buy these pants, we're going to be helping little kiddies in the United States, but you cannot do it on the backs of children in Honduras who are paid 31 cents an hour and treated like slaves. When we put that out, and Kathy Lee was crying and threatening to sue and everything, we found out that she did have a foundation, but it wasn't quite Paul Newman-type foundation, that, in fact, she did contribute money. She made $9 million a year off of selling her name to Walmart, and 10% went to the kiddies and 90% to Kathy Lee. 90% to Kathy Lee, 10% to the kiddies. When they found out that we knew, we never heard again about a lawsuit. But Primetime Live came in, they wanted to do a cover-up, a puff piece on Kathy Lee, same network. And they say to me, Kathy Lee says, why should we believe you that children work in the factory? So I gave them a smaller version of this picture. And I got a call back 2 or 3 hours later, or an hour and a half later, and they said, Kathy Lee looked at the picture and threw it aside and said, these people could be anybody, they're nobodies. Well, they didn't know we were setting them up, because at that very moment, this young girl was on a plane to the United States. When Kathy Lee was going with the mouth that they're nobodies, Wendy Diaz was on a plane coming to the United States. And she was 13 years old when she started to work in the factory. She worked the 12-hour shifts making the Kathy Lee pants. She was 15 years old when she came to the United States. She had a third-grade education. She had never traveled before. We had to fight for her visa, fight for her passport. She's on a plane coming to the United States, and the human rights group calls me Code, and they say she's on the plane. She's been accompanied by Esperanza Reyes, who's, in my opinion, like a real hero, a tremendous women's rights leader with CODE, the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights. And everything's all set, they say. And they say to me, by the way, this kid doesn't talk. And I got really upset over the phone. I said, what do you mean she doesn't talk? Why are you sending someone who doesn't talk? She's going to be interviewed by the New York Times. She's going to be on the radio and television. She's going to testify in Congress. Why are you sending someone who doesn't talk? Well, they said, I don't know, we couldn't get her to talk. When she came to the United States, the only reason she hadn't spoken was no one had taken her seriously before. No one had asked her opinion. No one had spoken with her seriously, listened to her. No one was interested in her opinion. When she came to the United States, she was so full of courage and so full of dignity that it took her 2 weeks to demolish Kathy Lee Gifford and Walmart. To the point I felt sorry for Walmart, and I was going to pull little Wendy off of them. She was cleaning them. I mean, we did congressional hearings.
WEOS Geneva,
we were doing congressional hearings in front of, like, Rayburn or Cannon, I forget which building.